Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it.
All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold cut combo, veggie delight, or Black Forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.
Hello, I'm Shoaib Kutin. With me, Matt Armitage and Fikri Fazil, both regulars on BFM, and myself. And today we're going to be having three topics. It's Bat Caves, Universal Basic Income in the Arts, and the techno revolution in sports. Will it ever happen for Malaysia? So let's begin with my topic, Bat Caves, not of the kind of comic version, but of the real version. I want to talk about my first encounter with caves, you know, the floor of the cave being kind of sodden with bat guano, really springy and smelling really strong. And my plans to go to the Mulu Caves, it's been a lifelong dream. And I wonder if you guys have ever encountered a Malaysian, you know, tropical bat cave.
Not so much of a bat cave, but I've gone to the there are lots of caves outside Ipoh, and they're a bit more kind of touristy. You can do tours through them.
Oh.
I've done that kind of thing. They show you all the formations and the stalactites and that kind of thing, and the guides tend to get carried away. They point out shapes in the stalactites, so it'll be, you know, this one looks like a face, this one looks like a moon or whatever. And as you go through, they run out of things to compare them to. So we actually got, our guide said, and this one looks like a monkey in a jeep wearing a backpack. What are you on? But no, not so much.
Okay, so you've done some of this, some of the natural history. I mean, Fikri, are you interested in natural history?
Not yet, but talking about the Ipoh Cave, I remember there was a metal gig that happened in that cave a couple of years
ago. Wow.
Yeah. Or really big enough to have a gig with musicians.
Yes.
Yeah, the acoustics very good?
It's a cave, so it has a lot of natural reverb.
Okay, so this is really interesting because that famous those famous caves in France, Lascaux, you know, where they found that one of the earliest cave paintings,
yeah.
Which is, in fact, is people are focused on the images, right? But it's also a lot to do with the sound. The auditory quality of the cave apparently is partly about the worship that probably happened there. And there's a movie about Lascaux, actually. But anyway, I wanted to come back to the tropical thing because we're all focused on that is that there is so much of this country, I think, that we don't see when we are focused on the social and political, which, of course, is, you know, the stuff I do on BFM, like so much of it. And, you know, it's often very dreary and depressing, and I want to slip my wrist at the end of the day, every day, 5 days a week. But, you know, I think that one thing that does redeem this country is just its natural beauty. And I think if you get out of Kuala Lumpur and you start to explore things like the caves, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, my wife is a volunteer with an organization called MyCat, and she's trained to take groups of volunteers into the jungles of Taman Negara and look for poachers' traps. So they log the trails, and they look for signs that poachers have been there. They look for what they've been trapping, whether it's deer or whether it's looking for tigers or looking for any of the other big cats that are there.
Are there any tigers left in Malaysia?
Yes, of course. Yeah, of course there are. And there are a few in the Taman Negara area. Obviously, they don't publish the information on sort of where they go and where they find signs of these animals, because that would be a red flag for the poachers themselves.
Right.
So, yeah, so there's all kinds of stuff going on in Malaysia, but so much of Malaysia is inaccessible.
Ah, I mean, Fikri, as a musician, as somebody who's in the arts, do you ever find inspiration in the natural environment? Is that something that excites you?
To be honest, I'm more of like an urban folk.
Yeah, oh.
So I'm an urban jungle kind of person. But I had this conversation, I think I mentioned it before. We used to have a Russian co-worker at our office. So I had this conversation with him about how in overseas, there's a lot of museums and, you know, all this kind of documented historical places. But he mentioned that, oh, actually in Malaysia, your museums are your, you know, your forests, your caves and stuff like that. So I was like kind of a bit shocked when he said
that. Oh, that's an interesting way of putting it. You know, the very few times does the landscape appear, I think, in Malaysian art and culture, you know. Well, maybe it's because I'm not as exposed as I could be. But I remember reading Chin Ping's book about the struggles of the Communist Party. And one of the things that becomes the background for the political journey that he's talking about is actually the trek that the Communist Party members take on the along the spine of Peninsular Malaysia. Right. So this is I'm not going to count Sabah and Sarawak, where there was a communist movement in Sarawak, at least there was. That's a very different one. But with the Communist Party of Malaya, you know, and they travel to the spine. Mm. And it's actually the backdrop of this very political story. But you don't, you know, he doesn't really focus on it, but it's there. And some of the discussions they had about how are they going to even get food? Because one assumes you go into this jungle and, you know, there's, you know, it's green all over and there's, you know, whatever, you know, animals and such. But what you do learn from reading natural history is that actually, 90% or 95% of vegetation can't be consumed by human beings, right? It's actually a very small percentage that actually can be food for human beings. And so, you know, all that extraordinary, you know, evolution of human beings in those environments, learning about what can be eaten and what can be eaten with that doesn't kill you, I think, is also more to the point, right? You could get killed very easily by things that look tasty.
I think that's sort of going back to what Fikri was saying about it it being the Museum of Malaysia. I think that's something that has been lost. I mean, my wife, when she goes into the jungle, takes an Orang Asli guide. And these guys, you know, treat it like their backyard. They know what they can eat. They know exactly where they are in the jungle. They don't have GPS. They don't have a compass. They're usually just, you know, barefoot or wearing Adidas Kampung. but they know this place like the back of their hand. Whereas city folk get lost in the forest just outside Churras or
Puchong. No, I got lost at the Tamantun Rimba.
Really?
The jogging part. I'm just kidding.
but that's what I mean. I mean, that's what I meant when I said earlier that so much of Malaysia is inaccessible. The jungle is not an easy thing to negotiate, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of training to actually understand that environment, to be able to operate in it independently.
And I think also we Malaysians in general, like the mass Malaysians, don't really explore this kind of places because there's so many myths surrounding it. There's a lot of stories about, like I was meeting, I know I met my grand uncle yesterday, so he was talking about in Lenggong, in Perak, there's a story about Hanuman and Sang Kelembai. So there's a lot of this kind of
folklore
that Malaysians, or at least the locals, really believe in. So they don't really go in and explore. It's like, you know, why would they?
Oh, is it taboo or something?
Yes.
Well, I'm going to come back after my trip to Mulu, and I'll give you a report on that bat cave. And but now we got to move on to our second topic, which is a universal basic income and the arts.
Yes.
Matt.
Well, I spoke about universal basic income on another show on BFM last week, but more from a technology perspective. Universal basic income, for people who don't know, is when every citizen in a country is guaranteed a monthly sum of income, a basic income that will cover all of life's needs. It's not a new idea. Thomas Paine, when he was helping to found the United States, he also said that every citizen in the US should receive a basic income, the idea being that it frees people up from having to work. It enables them to concentrate on
their
education, passions, all of this kind of thing. But the interesting thing is, I mean, it's been ignored for a couple of hundred years. It's become a bit more prevalent since the 1970s and 80s, but now it's being adopted by Silicon Valley, of all places, which is not the area of the area that you think will be sort of most progressive in terms of social policy. But this is actually one of those policies that's uniting people from the left wing and the right wing. So you've got your libertarians who like it because it's a simple payment. It streamlines government. It makes the function of government very simple. You don't have multiple welfare programs. On the left, it's popular because it provides a safety net for absolutely everybody. Again, it changes the way that we look at work. One of the things that Silicon Valley is doing is increasing mechanization, increasing automation, and all of that is leading to a reduction in jobs, which in the long run is bad for Silicon Valley because they still depend on people having jobs and earning money in order to buy the products and services that they produce. So this is about looking at solutions for a population of the future that is going to be less employed or underemployed, and making sure they have enough money and that they can actually keep the wheels of global commerce and finance actually rolling.
Okay, I'm going to ask Matt what his opinion about this idea is. I'm going to ask you, do you think it's going to promote sloth and laziness?
If it's being executed by itself, yes. But if people are educated about it, I think it can be reduced. I think to just kind of throw that idea out to Malaysians, for instance, I'm not too sure if it would work because Malaysians just generally tend to, you know, not.
Well, I mean, people will be excited by the idea of not having to work and still being able to pay their rent and make, you know, have enough in their pockets to buy their cigarettes and go to the warung and eat some food, right? I mean, that I think will excite most people, yeah. Right? They got the dole, isn't
but,
it?
But yeah, like the dole used to be in the UK.
In Britain, yeah, that's right. You just get some money.
But the question is after implementing it for, say, 5 or 10 years, how do you encourage people to innovate
is there a deliverable? I mean, first of all, you say we guarantee your income and you have to accomplish nothing.
Okay,
necessarily.
There's an example in France. I think in the arts community in France, they're actually implementing this now, even in Singapore actually. So you can apply as an artist, you can be a musician, dancer or whatever. You can apply to NEC, for instance, in Singapore, and they would give you a monthly income, but you need to set deliverables. So if you're a musician, you need to kind of submit a proposal saying, I will release one album, I will tour Europe for 6 months or stuff like that.
But that's not the same, right? I mean, philosophically, this proposal that Matt has outlined, it really is about freeing people from actually, sort of de-linking your ability to live and sustain yourself and your productiveness. I mean, in fact, it's something saying you don't have to be productive. If you are, well, all the better for your society, but it's not necessary, right?
It's just not necessary, no. The organizations looking into this is Y Combinator, which is one of the big investment funds in Silicon Valley. They've funded Reddit, Airbnb, Dropbox. They've been very, very successful. And they've just launched a research arm specifically looking into various modes of universal basic income. The premise being, they think that even if 90% of people sit around playing PlayStation and, like you said, you know, buying the cigarettes and going to the warung, that's fine. As long as the other 10% are innovating, they will be generating enough income to pay for all of the other 90%.
Okay, so 90% of slackers are going to be living off the 10% of people who are internally motivated to do something regardless.
Absolutely. And
can I just have my opinion is, this is a bad idea. I think of, you know, some great artists over the years. I think, you know, people like Franz Kafka, who had this terribly boring job, but then in the spare time created these amazing visions of the world. Or somebody like Raymond Chandler, who, you know, writes these great detective novels, who worked in oil and gas for much of his life before he retired and took so much of that understanding of human beings and put it into his novels. I mean, if people from the get-go don't have to experience life, don't have to struggle, don't have to deal with, you know, evil bosses and, you know, horrible counterparts, then what will they put into their art?
I think the wider question is that the jobs are going to be disappearing anyway. So it's going to be a question that you're not going to have this job. You're not going to have this opportunity to go to work. Or if you do, you're going to be part-time employed or you're just going to be working, you know, one day a week, 2 days a week, it's probably going to be fairly mindless toil.
I think for me, in my opinion, I think it's definitely beneficial, but it's also a double-edged sword. Leaving the, you know, the world's innovation to the 10% to a small group of elites is quite, it's a scary idea
for me. It is a scary idea, but again, if you look at, we were talking about the dole in the UK. If you look at the UK back in the 1970s and 1980s, it had very generous unemployment benefits. And you had an explosion of arts and culture in the UK in the 70s and 80s. The UK became one of the global leaders in sort of popular culture during that time, partly because so many people didn't have to go out and get a mindless job. You had the young British artists. That's when they started to come through. They were able to get benefits. They were able to get cheap warehousing and have studios. You had the punk explosion in the late 1970s, which was a music and arts movement, which, I mean, it transformed everything from typography through to just the fashion. I mean, it had an incredibly huge impact. And again, the new romantic movement that brought bands like Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet and Culture Club. All Gold. Of this, yeah, absolutely. But a lot of this can be attributed to the doll culture that the UK had at that time, even coming through to the Britpop era of the early 1990s. And you haven't seen that same mass of culture since the 1990s, when the benefits were cut.
Okay, so we hold Britain up as a model. Nigel Farage or Farage or whatever he calls himself, being the, and Boris Johnson being the pinnacle of British culture at this point in time.
Absolutely, yes.
We're going to have to leave this question. I think it's be very productive. We must come back to this again, where Britain really leads in thinking about culture and whether the dole can actually provide the catalyst for it. Sorry to cut you off there, Matt, but that's, you know, right. We have to move on, and we'll be coming back after this with more on A Bit of Culture. BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Sharad Kutin, Fikri Fazil, and Matt Armitage. And we're going to be talking about technological revolution in sports, and will it ever appear on our shores? Fikri, you had some thoughts about this.
Yes, I think this topic for me started, this is coming off the Silicon Valley idea. Silicon Valley is really spearheading, really trying to disrupt everything in this world, I think, from businesses to management style. So in this example, at least this story, I was reading this article on the New York Times about this venture capitalist called Joe Lacob, who was the ex-CEO of OpenTable, one of these tech companies, who bought over Golden State Warriors. It's a basketball team in America. And how, when he first bought it, he bought it for like $450 million. And then everyone in the NBA, all the pundits were like, oh, this guy is crazy. What, he doesn't know what he's doing. But he used the Silicon Valley management style to turn it around. Now, Golden State Warriors have people like Stephen Curry, you know, like this amazing point guard in their team. And in terms of income, they've turned it around to like, now it's worth $2 billion. So I'm trying to think about how technology or VCs or people in tech could probably solve a lot of things in sports.
Are they the new saviors? Are they the messiahs of the 21st century? The techies?
I don't think they're the messiahs of the 21st century. But I think they're the tax avoiders of the 21st century. But there's an awful lot of technology that can be used and applied. I don't necessarily think the so-called messiahs and the technology need to be linked. We can actually have one without the other. But at the same time, you've got guys like Elon Musk who are incredibly interesting, if odd.
Okay, I mean, Fikri, did I mischaracterize what you were saying by calling them tech messiahs? Is it that they have a lot of money and that's why they can do these things? Or is it because they bring particular, a new thinking about?
It's a new thinking. And plus, they have a lot of money. So when they have a lot of money, people just tend to agree. But the idea that they're trying to bring the old way of management, because you have to understand NBA teams are owned by, you know, developers, people who say if there's a formula, if it's not broken, why fix it? But tech people would come in and say, okay, you know what, let's do something new. something very refreshing. And you could sense that in a couple of things in Malaysia as well, and how the tech guys are trying to just introduce a new way of living in this world.
Breaking the mold, Matt, do you think that's what's happening?
Well, partly it's breaking the mold, but also they have a different attitude to money and risk. Mm-hmm. Technology by its nature is high risk. The venture capitalist model is you invest in 100 firms, and the idea is, we're going back to the 90%, 10% argument from before, 90% will fail, 10% will succeed, the 10% pay for the 90% that fail. And I think it's this same attitude. They can go into a project like this with close to $500 million and say, well, if it doesn't work, doesn't matter. You know, he'll still be able to sell out for 300, 350 million. You know, he'll lose a bomb, but by his own reckoning, it's not that much money.
Which is extremely refreshing, because it's, you know, you compare to all the big tycoons in Malaysia, at least, everyone wants to know what the KPI is, when these guys are just there to try out the idea. And if it doesn't work, it's okay. So it's really against the grain, again, with the idea that we all need to make money. And
okay, so I think one of those overused words in culture and in industry today is revolution, right? Everybody talks about revolution.
But, of course.
But is it, in fact, revolutionary? I mean, a little tweak here, there's a different, business model. Does that constitute a revolution?
Okay, for instance, Airbnb is the biggest hotel company in the world. So Uber is the biggest tech.
Okay, so I've heard the spiel, right?
Right.
Airbnb is the biggest hotel company without owning a single hotel.
Yes.
I mean, that's always the tagline.
Right.
And you hear all these guys come on stage and start, and it's always amazing the first 10 times you hear it. And then after a while, you're thinking, okay.
Well, I mean, I'm a bit wary of the terms revolution and disrupt, because, you know, they're just buzzwords. It's like Synergy was a few years ago. You know, there's a point where you just start to cringe when you hear these terms. But I think it's the way that things are used and the way they're adopted. I mean, there's a lot of coverage for Google about the way it's developing these self-driving autonomous cars. Now, Google doesn't want to be a car manufacturer. It's doing this because it's all about processing data, and Google is a data company. So they are creating a revolution in the automobile industry, but they didn't necessarily set out to do that. They set out to find better ways for their sensors to collect data and send it back to Google. So it's kind of an ancillary effect. Yes, sometimes they're revolutionary, but they don't necessarily set out to be revolutionary.
Okay, so one of the things I've watched this TED talk about sports, right? So the other term that you used, so with both technology and these techies, but it was also sports that you wanted to talk about. And this TED talk is talking about the why it is that sports and achievements in sports have just kind of risen exponentially. And it has to do with the gene pool that is now having access to these events. It's about selection, you know, and or self-selecting processes that happen in sports, and a whole range of other processes that allow somebody, I think somebody's done it, run up the Matterhorn. I mean, think of the most incredibly ridiculous thing to do. I mean, it's bad enough trying to walk up the damn thing or climb to run up. Apparently people are doing these things. They're running up mountains.
Yeah, there was one guy, he's been uncovered as a potential fraud, but he was trying to pretty much run across the US by running a marathon a day, and he was recording incredible times. But when drones and camera crews and things followed along behind his bus, he was apparently not always running, and the bus was just rolling along at 6 kilometers an hour on its own. So whether or not he was doing that, we don't know. But yes, people are pushing themselves further and further.
Right. Okay. Time for recommendations. I'm going to start with The Bat Caves. I was just saying, Chin Peng's book, which came out a couple of years ago, maybe even 10 years ago by now, is actually quite brilliant. Even if you don't like politics, you could focus on the landscape. So that would be my recommendation.
Lovely.
Matt, what do you have for us?
I am going to recommend keeping a journal, which is something that I try and fail to do absolutely miserably. But just the process of getting up in the morning and recording sort of some of the more memorable things that happened the day before. You don't have to write a lot. You can just write, you know, a few points.
That's very interesting. Yeah,
it's very good for kind of refreshing your memory on what happened the day before. It's good for focusing your mind on the day ahead, especially if you've got a universal basic income and you've got no work.
Ooh, you're trying to slide it in.
Yeah,
I noticed that.
Very subtle. Yeah, so keep a journal.
Okay. Fiku, do you keep a journal?
I just started keeping a journal, actually.
Wow, that's interesting.
For work and for my personal life. And it's I do agree. Every time I would wake up or start my day, I would just kind of write a few things I need to do, and I feel organized already.
All right. So, okay. Yeah. I only keep journals when I go traveling. So I actually have a collection of travel journals.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, but it's very good at the start, and then by the end, by the middle of the trip, it sort of tapers off, and then I'm sticking, you know, bus tickets and stuff just to make up for the lack of text.
Letting a pigeon boop on the page, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Very artistic. Yeah. Very artistic.
Okay, so I would like to recommend this book by a Malaysian band called Butterfingers. They were big in the 90s. It's a good insight to the popular culture through the lens of music of the Malaysian music industry in the 90s. It's called Selamat Tinggal Dunia. It's about their journey from the start when they were, you know, big record label boys until now where they are independent and trying to relive that 90s era of music. So I would really recommend that for people.
Wonderful. Yeah. That's all we have for a bit of culture this week. Thank you very much. You can, of course, send us Twitter. Are you Twitter, Matt?
I am on Twitter, but get me on Instagram. It's much easier. I'm at culturepop, KULTURPOP on Instagram.
Okay. And Fikri, how do people interact, engage with you?
I'm on Instagram as well. It's _bayangan.
Oh, wow. I'm really not gotten to the Instagram revolution.
It's better than
no
Twitter.
No synergies with my current life. So I've stuck with Twitter. Twitter's the thing, at Sharad Kutan, if you're interested at all in my rambling thoughts. So that's all we have for this week. You can also join us on Facebook. That's A Bit of Culture. That's our name on Facebook. And, you know, you can interact with us there. Cam, I believe, will be coming back very soon. Very soon, if we can't help it. Okay. Thank you again, Matt Fikri, and myself, Sharad Kutan. This has been A Bit of Culture on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it.
All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold cut combo, veggie delight, or black forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.